Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started so we don't cut the time short for these two guys, because I know this will be a long session. What a privilege to get to introduce these two guys. But let me tell you what we're doing. And I've been told to stick to the script. Too many people have been to my two-hour webinars, so we'll stick to the script. So hello and welcome, everybody, to Modern Hopping Techniques in the West Coast IPA. That's correct, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Close enough. All right, close enough. And then my screen disappears. That's this script stuff I'm not sure I like. My name is Doug Piper, and I'm a member of the governing committee, as well as the founder and host of the Gourmet Brewing Channel, where we just recently did one on West Coast IPAs with Vinny Cherluzzo.
What does he know?
Before we get started, we do need to get everybody to take their seats as quickly as possible. I know there's beer over there, but I just heard them announce that they will bring the beer around. So, hey, this is table service here. Nothing slack about HomebrewCon. Please silence your cell phones because we are recording this. And so we really don't want to hear cell phones going off, or you don't want to hear them when you go to listen to the replay later. We will take questions, but we'll hold them to the end. But it's essential that you use the microphones. It's a big room, and it's being recorded. And if you don't use the mic, your question will not be heard. And I know it's an important burning question, and we want that. The QR code, if I hit it right. So if you hit that QR code, my understanding is you can get access to hundreds of recordings. So please do that. At the end of the session, please make sure that you submit the feedback survey. Now, being on the governing committee, we do look at those surveys, and it's really important. So we would appreciate you doing those. So let me introduce you to two people who don't need introductions, and I'm the one that needs an introduction more than you guys do. Drew Beecham and Denny Kahn. Drew is hailing from Pasadena. Is a seasoned home brewer and writer, and known for his book Simple Home Brewing, Great Beer, Less Work, More Fun, and the co-host of Experimental Brewing podcast. But you got a new book out, don't you?
Is that newer than that one?
Simple's the last one.
Okay. Denny with a stunning record.
I'm stunned.
Only to be, getting close to crispy. 580 batches of beer.
602 now.
602. I'm always out of touch. He's co-authored numerous homebrewing books and articles. His influence even earned him the namesake of a brewing yeast strain. And like Drew, he co-hosts Experimental Brewing. And together today, they're going to be a real powerhouse. Now, I've just got one more question. 600 and how many?
Two.
Anybody come close to 602 homebrews? 427. Anybody higher than 427?
I heard a 508. Do I hear a 550? Do I hear a 550? Go on.
Thank you, Denny.
Thanks,
Welcome.
Doug. Thank you.
Well, isn't there one guy down in Australia? Remember, he's got something like 1,000 batches under his belt.
Yeah,
it's absolutely insane.
There's a guy, Vincent Callio, who's brewed like 1,200 batches.
There you go. All right. But that's a digression. We promise you there aren't going to be very many digressions today because you're going to have to hold on to your butts.
Yeah, we got more stuff than we have time for here. So let me right now encourage you to use that QR code to download this presentation later because we're going to be at cruising speed today. Woo! So that's us. You know us. You know, you've heard us before. You've heard us talk. You've read our stuff. So, why this talk?
Over the last decade or so, you know, Denny and I are both avowed West Coast IPA aficionados. Hazy IPA is okay sometimes. Depends. But Hazy IPA is the one that's getting all the love right now. But also thanks to Hazy IPA, we're learning a lot of new ways to use hops. So really what we wanted to do is sit down and go, okay, what's being done right now with hops and hop science, and how can we apply that to our preferred style of beer, the West Coast IPA?
Oh, is this me? Okay, so let's just contrast these real clear. West Coast IPA is going to be clear, maybe a little haze, but it's going to be minimal. It's going to be, if not brilliant, very close to it. A crisp, bracing bitterness, at least a 1-to-1 BU to GU ratio, and the prominent hop character is going to be citrus and pine and some tropical thrown in there, too. The hazy is going to be hazy to murky. Annie has described them as gravy beer. It's going to have a soft, round, rich mouthfeel, low IBU bitterness. Remember, IBUs are kind of a moving target. And it's going to be an aggressive hop sensory with emphasis on the fruit and tropical characters. Now, there are three schools of West Coast IPA. There's the traditional that I started brewing 25 years ago when I was brewing, which was basically 90% of a two-year-old pale base malt and 10% crystal 60, had a hard bite, and there's still some around, but you just don't see that particular formulation that much anymore. The current Northwest may use a little crystal, but more likely to have some Vienna or Munich thrown in for some character. So, and the malt is often a pils malt instead of a pale malt. And the hop quality is really resinous. That reminds me, you still have that beer in my room.
Ooh.
And then you have the San Diego style of Pilsner, the Southwest style as opposed to the Northwest style, paler Pilsner focused, and hops like by the massive buttload.
Yep, absolutely. And so the schools, by the way, these are really rough guidelines because obviously beer guidelines are woogie at best, but those are kind of what we're seeing and what we've seen over time. What we're also seeing right now is what I've been referring to as the modern West Coast IPA. And the modern West Coast IPA is sort of a bridge between some of that Northwest and some of that San Diego thing. It is a lower bittered beer. It is not as bracingly, aggressively bittered as your traditional West Coast IPA, usually.
Sometimes, maybe.
Yeah. A lot more emphasis on the aroma and flavor. This is where I think the West Coast IPA is going with the lessons learned from East Coast IPAs and that hazy thing, right? Because it turns out, oh, everybody loves the smell of apricots in your face, right? And so that's kind of what is happening here with the modern West Coast. So there we go.
Okay, so this is how you conceptualize what you're doing with your hops. And this is my philosophy. You start off by picturing that you taste the beer in your mind. You use your taste imagination so that you have a really good idea of what your goal is. For me, it's always much more successful if I have a goal I'm trying to reach and figure out what things I need to do to get there than if I throw a whole bunch of stuff together to see what happens. Right? So you want to take into account the malt flavor. What's the yeast profile? Because if you're using, like, say, a fruity yeast, you're going to want to think about how that's going to play with the hops. If you're using a really clean yeast, you need to realize that that's not going to influence the hops. What's the strength of the beer? How bitter is it going to be? Because, you know, the strength matters because alcohol adds sweetness. The bittering counters that. And then you think about what kind of flavors do you want. The classic pine and citrus, tropical, a blend between the two. It's up to you, but picture that beer. Taste that beer in your head first. Hey, he made it.
All right, and everybody who's drinking the beer right now, there's Kelsey. He's the one who actually did the hard work on it. So
let's give Kelsey a big hand.
All right. So one of the biggest things that's been changing in hops right now is the rise of more fruity hops. I was only partially joking about apricots, right? You know, there are a lot of hops out there now where if you look at the flavor descriptors, they're like, this smells like melons, apricots, and sandalwood. You know, something like that.
I just saw one that's supposed to be like yuzu.
There you go. Yep. Now, the big question is, given that we are talking about West Coast IPA, do these big fruity hops work in a West Coast IPA? The beer in front of you is the answer to that question, yes. However, I think you and I are still both at odds with the new hops that are coming out there, like heavily coconut and woody in an IPA.
It took me a while, like Sabro, I think you're thinking of, and it took me a while to adjust to that flavor and figure out how to use it, which was I don't. Okay, does malt matter in an IPA? Absolutely, malt matters, because that is the foundation that your hops are going to be laying on top of. Yeah, when you use a really stripped-down malt bill, you need to remember to use really good malt. A craft malt, heritage malt, something like that will definitely make a big difference in your beer. For this beer, we used a Rahr North Star Pils malt, and that is just a wonderful, flavorful malt. You know, so that was a good basis for Kelsey to start with, and he threw in a little bit of Weyermann Vienna also on top of it.
Yeah, and remember, in this particular case, a good quality base malt doesn't necessarily have to be an assertive one, right? So there are some of the other heritage malts out there, like we're both big fans of the Crisp Chevalier malt, mm-hmm. which is the original IPA malt. Right? And that would make a perfectly good IPA, but you have to remember that's going to be very in your face with the malt.
Yeah,
you
right.
You have to adjust your expectations.
Yep. Or if you're using, say, something like Maris Otter or something like that, that's going to provide a lot more of a, I don't want to say flavor barrier, but it's a flavor hump that you're going to have to get over with your hops. Crystal versus toasted malts, you know, people are in these days not into using crystal. They say that it oxidizes the beer. Maybe so. Maybe sometimes that's a good thing. Maybe sometimes it's not. And remember, different malts provide different amounts of bound thiols. So if you're a brewer who's into thiols, take a look at the malts you're using in regard to that also.
Yeah, and also keep an eye out, because I know there are some people who are out there who are trying to figure out a way to systematically describe the amount of bound thiol in malt, you know, and give you a list for that.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah. But one very important piece of the malt choice, no oats.
No oats. No
and I'm
oats.
Saying
never,
that.
Never.
I love oats. No oats in a West Coast IPA.
Okay.
All right. Now, on water, obviously we know that water matters. It is 95, maybe 90% or 80% of the beer for some of you crazy maniacs. But obviously start with clean filtered water. A lot of people will sort of obsess over the sulfite to chloride ratio, right? I mean, this was a thing that people weren't talking about 5 years ago, even. Now, suddenly, everything's about sulfite and chloride ratio. But remember that you'll hear a lot of people talk about, okay, hey, you know, 2-to-1, 1-to-1, 3-to-1, that sort of ratio. But don't get hung up on the ratio exclusively. Also pay attention to the actual mineral load, right? Because 50 ppm of chloride and 100 parts of sulfate will still taste radically different than 100 parts per million of chloride and 200 parts of sulfate, right? You know, so same ratio.
Pay attention to the numbers, the exact amounts, more than the ratio.
Yeah. And the other thing I will also tell you is don't skimp on the acid. You know, pay attention to actually what the acid's going to do, because in a West Coast IPA or an IPA in general, any of these things that we're doing heavy dry hops with, your heavy dry hops are going to affect the acid, the pH of your beer, which shockingly also changes the flavor profile. So we'll talk a little bit about that. All right.
Okay, yeast choices make a lot of difference. I mean, we're talking here 1056 versus 1318 for just as an example. 1056, you know, is a very clean, crisp yeast. 1318 is a fruitier yeast that is really a favorite of New England IPAs. There's, you know, you need to take it into account what it's going to do. Beyond biotransformation, just the yeast itself can affect the perception of the hops in the beer. You know, like one of the reasons we didn't use Y-Yeast 1450 in this beer, which I would have loved to have done, is because it would leave too much of a mouthfeel for the crispness that we were going for in this beer. So we used Y-Yeast 1217 instead, which these days I'm referring to as Denny's second favorite. And, you know, it just is, it's a really clean, crisp beer where the yeast gets out of the way. And you definitely want to use yeast with reduced esters, you know. Yeah. And you can use Kolsch yeast if you want. You can try some lager strains if you want.
Well, I was going to say, some of the best IPAs that we're having produced up in L.A. are produced with 3470, right? Saf Lager 3470. You know why? Because it is a clean, crisp yeast that gets the fuck out of the way. Pardon my French. All right, so here's a little lesson, just another sort of thing to think about. Here's how hops have changed over time. If you remember pre-craft, the hop industry was all basically focused on two things. We want to make something noble that's American, because you have to have something in Budweiser. We also wanted something that had a lot of alpha acid, because, fuck, we don't want to put alps in Budweiser. We want extract, right? So more alpha acid, the better you are for your extract. Then we start to get into the classic craft world. This is when we see the hops that Denny and I both love dearly, the Cascades, the Chinooks, the Centennials, the Columbus Tomahawk Zeus, all one same strain. But that was when America really sort of embraced the idea of resinous, dank, and citrus, back before we could talk about things being dank legally here otherwise. And then when I first really got in, like seriously moving up in the homebrewing world, that's when we started to see the whole rise of low cohumulone, right? And that became everybody's obsession for a while. And that's when we started to see the rise of hops that are still really kind of kicking everybody's butt today. Amarillo, Simcoe, and of course the number one hop in America for craft brewers, Citra. I'm not entirely certain you're allowed to legally brew an IPA in America that doesn't have Citra somehow. Yeah, Galaxy and Mosaic seem to be optional, but highly recommended too. So that's where we are there. Now we're starting to see, because of the rise of the Neo-Mexicanos type hops, we're starting to see more of these, what I was just referring to, the tropical fruit characters, but also some of these that have coconut and wood in them. If you go and look at the Yakima Chief website right now, and Yakima Chief is the one that provided all the hops for this beer, they list 130-plus varieties of hops that are available. Now, that never used to be a thing. It really used to be like, I've got Cascade and Centennial. What the hell else do I need?
Yeah, Willamette.
Willamette, damn it. And even Barth Haas has like 99-plus varieties. And that's before you even start to really explore what happens around the rest of the world. All right, now we go into Denny's favorite world.
So this is the old school way. That's yeah. So clean, neutral, this is the way, you know, again, the IPAs used to be thought of in terms of hopping. You started with a clean, neutral, bittering hop. Drew likes Warrior. I'm more of a Chinook fan for my IPAs. I like that bite. I like a West Coast IPA that slaps you in the face.
Well, see, you can pay extra for that, by the way. I mean, to me, I always like my Warrior with just a touch of Chinook. I like that, just that little.
Yeah. Ooh.
Oh, good.
So, but think of a flavor profile and then run with it. Don't get confused. There's nothing wrong with blending hop varieties and using a number of them. But once again, taste and smell in your mind how they're going to play together. Don't just start throwing things in there randomly, unless you're just in it to see what happens. In general, you will have a better outcome if you focus on what you want to have. For citrus, you go with Cascade, Centennial, Simcoe, Citra, for instance, Pine and Dank, Columbus, Chinook, and you know, we're listing Strata as tropical, but that can really be dank also. So I've often heard Strata referred to as the weed hop because. Yeah. That's what it tastes like.
you put your weed in here.
Really?
If you laughed at that, you're old. All right. Other thoughts before we break into one of what we think is probably a key development in the hop world right now. Stop focusing on the IBU. As we've discovered in doing analysis of beers, as I think a lot of people have started to discover, particularly in the world of heavily dry-hopped beers, the IBU is basically meaningless in so many ways. It doesn't do what we need it to do in order to adequately describe how hoppy is this beer. It's a lot of the same way of talking like how sour something is by talking about pH. And there's kind of a correlation, but not a lot. So in this case, really don't focus so much on IBUs. Make sure you have enough bitterness. But the rest of what you're really wanting is not those same compounds that show up as isomerized alpha acids, right? Maximize what you get from the hops. Don't maximize the varieties. I've seen, for years, I gave a talk called Brewing on the Ones, right? Love that talk. It's all about simplification, like focusing, making sure that you focus what you're doing with your recipe. And I believe that's actually a huge problem for homebrewers in a lot of ways, including in IPAs, where it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I made this IPA. It has 15 different types of hops. And, you know, where I joked around with Brewing on the Ones that, you know, brewing with everything in the kitchen sink would make your beers taste brown. In this particular case, this just makes your beers taste green, right? All right, and so give you a good idea of we'll get into that. But first, we do have to show this. I was going to do a whole slide on hop chemistry, and then I decided, screw it. Scott Janisch already did it for me. So this comes from Scott Janisch's website and also his new IPA book, which is an awesome book. If you haven't read it, go and read that. He delves deeply into hop chemistry, deeply nerdily. It's fantastic. But these are the compounds that we see in hops, all these different things, the alpha and beta acids, which we all talk about, right? You know, that's right there on the package. But also things like the various hydrocarbons, the monoterpene alcohols, the sulfur compounds. If that didn't just make you kind of go, huh? Then yes, absolutely read the book because you want more of the hop chemistry in there. But these are the vital bits, and they come into play with the next bit.
Okay. We're going to talk now about survivable compounds in hops based on research done by Yakima Chief. This information changed my entire way of making IPAs and conceptualizing how I'm going to make IPAs. Yakima Chief has done research into what hop compounds survive at different stages of use, right? Which hops you can use earlier in the boil, which hops you will get more out of later in the boil. And the other thing is, by comparing the different levels of these compounds in different hops, you can make more effective hop choices. Survival compounds are things like geraniol, linalool, stuff like that. They survive the violence of brewing. This chart is going to be really hard for you to see, but this is why we want you to download this. And you can find information on survivables at Yakima Chief's website, along with this great booklet that you can download that tells you how to make use of them, gives you some example recipes, stuff like that. The different colored lines you're seeing here on this graph are different survivable compounds in the hops. So basically, you want to use hops with high survivables early in the brewing process, but they'll still work late. You want to use low survivables, like post-fermentation dry hopping. You want to blend hops with different oils to maximize the benefit. For instance, laurel is high in linalool, talus is high in geraniol. They can work really well together. Whereas if you put both laurel and crystal together that are both high in linalool, you're going to be getting a big hit of linalool without the dynamic combination of those reinforcing compounds in the hops.
Which is fine if that's what you want. The big key out of this is really, like, looking back at that chart. Oops, wrong direction. Here you go. There you go, Beecham. Looking back at this chart, you know, the survivables concept is really very heavy use for commercial brewers, right? Because a lot of it's about here. You can use this old funky variety that has a lot of the survivable characteristics that are cheaper and save your more expensive hops for later in the boil, right, or later in the process, and use them more efficiently. But for me, the biggest thing about this is now we get this nice visual breakdown of all of these various oils, right, so that we can sit there and think about, okay, well, you know, I know what geraniol smells like, I know what linalool smells like, I know what, you know, all these things are. How do I add these together? And being able to look at a chart like this is so much more useful to me.
Yeah, and I really urge all of you who are interested in improving your IPAs to dig into this concept. Go to the Yakima Chief website, download the booklet, read some of the research they've done, listen to some of the seminars they've done on it, because understanding and using the survivable concept will really, really alter your IPAs.
Yeah, and I think the key takeaway is it's very easy for homebrewers in particular, or brewers really, to just kind of go, okay, look, I've got this descriptor on a Yakima Chief website, right? And I'm going to take a little of this, I'm going to take a little of that, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. And it's really hard for us to describe rules to think about this, right? Like, how do you choose what you're going to do? And survivables, at least, is one concept that seems to give, like, some very nice clear-cut rules that you can think of, that you can use as a guideline to drive what you're doing, actually, with your hops. All right, so real quick, we'll go through the hop products here real quick. Whole cone hops, we know them, we love them, we never see them anymore. They are less processed.
I can't remember the last time I used whole hops.
Well, but then you got folks out there like Vinny who...
No, yeah, sure.
Vinny still uses whole hops.
Sierra Nevada.
Yep, Sierra Nevada. Yeah.
Everything's aged, John.
And speaking of age, I don't know if you all watched this, but recently in like the past 2-3 years, you can now get flash frozen fresh hops. Used to be that if you wanted fresh hops, you either had to grow your own or you had to know somebody. or you had to be around like when somebody brought hops in. But now you can actually get flash frozen hops. However, those are not part of this talk because that's a completely different beer. T90 pellets, T90 pellets, even if you don't know T90 pellets, it's what everybody uses. The other thing that we don't see anymore, except for kind of transformed, is the T45, which was just a more concentrated product. So speaking of concentrated products, here we go. We got the idea is now that everybody's loading their fermenters, we've all suddenly discovered that green is a bad flavor, right? Yeah, the green is the flavor of hop burn, and we don't want that anymore. So now what we're starting to see is we're seeing more hop products that are coming out that are sort of concentrated, right? We'll remove some of the vegetation. We'll make them easier to use. You'll get more oils in your beer. And so the big ones out there are Cryo, again from Yakima Chief. Cryopop, Yakima Valley has Lupamax, instance, or Barthos. And they always, my favorite part about this is they say, oh, hey, look, you can use this as a 1-to-2 ratio. You can use one part of Cryo to replace two parts of T90s. Bold. Nobody does that.
Yeah. I use at least as much Cryo as T90 and sometimes more because it's so wonderful.
Yeah. So additional things that are coming out, liquids, right? So you got Spectrum and Incognito, which are currently on the market. You can actually get Incognito now as a home brewer via Yakima Valley Hops. In this beer, you've got the YCH702, which is a trial product. It's their version of a flowable liquid extract.
This version is made from Citra.
Yeah, this was a Citra one. Easy to add to the kettle. They don't do the same thing that extracts do. Extracts tend to be very hard to dissolve. These things are designed to be easily dissolved. And, of course, now we're seeing more and more extracts at the homebrew level. And we've even been seeing people playing around with terpenes, right? Actually saying, you know what? Screw the hops. We're going straight to the chemical source. And we're gonna find the thing that smells like linalool. Why bother with trying to find something that smells like linalool? Let's make linalool, right? And let's dose that in. And then, of course, the new hop stuff is thials. And I think you all have been hearing about thials, right? You've been hearing about Phantasm and whatnot. Here's part of my problem with it, is I think we both agree on this, and Kelsey, I think you agreed to this too when we were talking last night. The more processed these products become, the more one note they get, right? They deliver a really big note of one thing. I can't tell you the number of times I've had a beer that is like thiol enhanced with Phantasm and like one of the, like the Omega yeast, for instance, that does the thiol releasing. You pop open the can, and the can smells like a dream, right? It's one of those ones where you have the glass at arm's length, and all you get is, passion fruit and guava and mango, right? And then you actually go take a sip of it, and it falls flat. And so I think we're seeing a lot of that. I feel very strongly that as much as I love these processed products and these different tools that we have, you still need to kind of build your backbone with whole hops, because whole hops have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of compounds.
Pellets.
The less processed product, because they have thousands of compounds in them that you're tasting and smelling. It's the same problem that happens with, say, candy produced here in the U.S., where, we added this ester to make this thing taste like cherry, right? You're missing out on a lot of the other flavor of cherry.
As much as I love cryo hops, I feel like they work better when you combine them with something that has some bract, some polyphenolic character to it. One of the products that Yakima Chief sells is called American Noble Hops, which are made from the bract left over from cryo hop processing. And I found that using a combination of those American Nobles and the cryo, you can kind of like design your own hop with just the amount of polyphenols that you like.
We have to go into turbo mode.
Okay. Yes, we do.
All right.
Okay, so when you're hopping, there's all the classic stuff. There's first word hopping. There's the 60-30-10-0 schedule. There's the zero kettle edition schedule that some people use. Remember, everything we're giving you today is a menu you can pick and choose from. Some of these things we've tried and we like. Some of these things we've tried and we don't like. Some of them we haven't tried at all. But what we want to do is give you an overview of everything that's out there.
All right, and so remember, again, our goal here is we want bright, clean hop character, and we want a nice, controlled bitterness, right? We don't want teeth shattering in this new style of IPA, but we do want something that reminds you, I'm an IPA, I'm bitter. The concerns that we have, and the concerns that you should have about your IPAs, hop burn. One of the biggest reasons why I don't like a lot of hazy IPAs is because they carry that very large green, you know, hop tannin, hop polyphenol type character to them that makes it okay to have like one,
if that,
and then I want something else because now my throat feels scratchy. So hop burn to me is actually the biggest problem I think homebrewers have and brewers have with making super hoppy beers. The other ones you'll also see, hop creep. Hop creep for us, if you don't know, hops have diastases in them that allows the sugar, leftover starches in your wort to slowly be converted into sugar, which your yeast can then pick up and re-ferment while the yeast are not in the best condition, right, and leading to diacetyl and other problems. Diacetyl is way more of a concern for professional brewers than it is for home brewers. There are things that you can do about it, but generally our rule is as long as you're keeping everything cold, you're generally fine.
I've done some tests trying to make hop creep happen because I hear home brewers talking about it so often. I can't get it to happen, you know, and maybe it's because of the process I'm using or whatever, but I've come to the conclusion that on a homebrew scale, hop creep is not a huge deal. Not impossible, but it's not a huge issue.
Yeah, and the last one is oxidation. Everybody, I'm seeing a lot of the hazy brewers out there do all sorts of really crazy tricks and new gadgets and gear that they put together to avoid adding extra oxygen when they're doing their hopping. If that's what you want to do, do that, but at the same time, yeah, avoid a lot of extraneous oxidation.
Right. So definitely use some kettle hops. They give you a nice backbone bitterness. They help the kettle break. Acidify your wort post-boil if you can. There's a great way. We've had Martin Brungard on our podcast before talking about how to use brewing water to predict the post-boil acidification that you need. And we don't have time to get into that right now, but if you write to us, we'll explain it to you. Maybe we'll even write it up and put it on the website.
Yeah, yeah, but the real trick is dry hops raise wort pH or finished beer pH, and the higher pHs generally are regarded as being flabby.
Right.
So that's the reason why you have to pay attention to your wort.
Whirlpool hopping is a very popular thing. Remember, you don't actually need to whirlpool. Commercial breweries whirlpool as part of their normal process. There's really no need for us to do that, but if you want to, you can. But you can dump the hops in and let them sit anyway. You don't really need to stir them around. Most people who are doing whirlpool hops cool their wort to like 180, 170 to do it. I accidentally, due to an incredible jaded chiller, dropped it down to 125 and did whirlpool hops at that temp once, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know?
Don't brew like my brother.
Try it, you know, what the heck. But on the other hand, I have moved away from whirlpooling in favor of dry hopping, but it's been a while since I've done it, so I think it's time for me to revisit it. Anything that I don't think that I like, I go back and do every once in a while just to make sure. And, yes, that includes decoction.
I was going to say, that doesn't include decoction for me because...
Yes, it does.
No, not for me.
Oh, right. Dip hopping, this is one of the new trendy things developed by Kirin in Japan. Basically what you do is you take about 10% of your wort, you cool it down to 150 or 170, add some hops to it, let it steep while the rest of the boil goes on, and you cool down your wort and add it back on top of that. Works best with linalool and geraniol-rich varieties, and here are some examples of those varieties there. I'm sorry, we're going fast here. Active fermentation dry hopping.
Right, so active fermentation hopping, easily very stolen from the world of hazies, right? The idea in the hazy world is to get some biotransformation going. Here with the West Coast IPA, we're not necessarily looking for biotransformation, right? There's a lot of debate just how much impact biotransformation has. But in our particular case, active dry hopping, the biggest thing I can tell you is you have to make sure your yeast is vital, right? We preach this all the time. If there is no lesson that you ever take away from any talk that we ever give and you want to make your best homebrew, it's have vital yeast.
Yep.
And that will help you here with active dry hopping because the big worry is that you don't want to kick off oxidative compounds. You don't want to kick off diacetyl, right? So good vital yeast.
Now, this is something that I've been into for the last couple of years is short, cold, dry hopping. I crash my beer down to 35 Fahrenheit. I add my dry hops for 48 to 72 hours and then keg the beer. I have been doing some experimentation with this later, and recently, and I have found that for my taste, a 48-hour dry hop gives me a lot more than a 72-hour dry hop. That's because after 48 hours, by research done by Shellhammer shows that the hops actually start reabsorbing their oils, and so you can end up getting less out of the hops the longer you leave them in there.
And now, then, by the way, that also includes things like isomerized alpha acids. A lot of stuff gets sucked back up into the plant material. All that stuff that you worked hard to get in there, it's going away. But by the way, actually, just go back real quick. One thing I did want to say, we're talking here about short and cold dry hopping. I've talked to a number of breweries out there, different professional brewers and home brewers. Short cold isn't a single technique, right? Denny's preferring short and cold because it's extracting compounds that he likes. But almost every brewer I have talked to has switched completely over to doing shorter dry hop times. It's no longer, hey, you let this beer sit on the hops for 10 days. So if you take nothing away from this slide, short.
Cold, maybe yes, maybe no, works for me, but short definitely works best.
All right, then of course, double dry hopping, triple dry hopping. The beer that you're having right now is a double dry hopped beer. At the homebrew level, not really a fan of double dry hopping. I don't think it really adds much to the beer, and it increases the risk that you have from oxidation and exposure of the wort. So I'm not a fan. Don't do it.
Yeah, and just because we're not a fan doesn't mean you can't do it, but give it a shot. Okay, so again, I mentioned Tom Shellhammer earlier. He's done some research about how much dry hops to use. And his research says that more than about 8 grams of dry hops per liter of beer yields diminishing returns because the hops just start re-soaking the oils and they express polyphenols. Citrus aroma oils saturated only 4 grams per liter, right? So if you're going for citrus, you can use even less dry hop. Herbal and tea aromas and things like cumulonones and polyphenols saturate at a much higher level, and you get hop burn city. So, you know, more is not necessarily better.
Well, I'm trying to remember what that one, that 8 grams per liter works out to.
About 6 ounces per 5 gallons.
So 6 ounces per 5 gallons. So Shellhammer's argument is that if you go over 6 ounces for a 5 gallon batch, then you're starting to get into a point of diminishing returns and also to a point where you're going to pick up other compounds.
Right.
So you're wasting hops and you're making your beer worse.
Okay, so then we talked to some brewers we know about their philosophies, and I'm not going to take the time to go through all this in detail, but please read it. Stephen Hughes is the owner and head brewer at Coldfire in Eugene, a wonderful, wonderful brewery. And so we asked him about his philosophy for making IPAs. He is very much a yeast-driven brewer. He starts by considering the contribution from the yeast, and then works to support that and add things to it that we're going to be working. This is a sample recipe. He's never actually brewed this recipe, but when we asked him for an example of what he does, he whipped this up for us. So you can take a look at that and get an idea of Stephen's philosophy of hopping. Then you have Balebreaker from Yakima, one of our favorite brewers.
Yeah, and you'll see a theme amongst all these brewers that we're talking to. Remember we said earlier, simple malt bill? Yeah, here Kevin Smith, who it always confuses me because I want to think Silent Bob, but Kevin Smith from Balebreaker, he is talking about, hey, you know, my malt bills are super, super simple. Even Stephen's malt bills are super simple. No crystal, but Munich and Vienna, which you get in this beer too. And then he also, I thought this was interesting. He pushes for a harder mineral ratio when he's in a darker beer, a darker IPA, if he's doing something more traditional. But when he's in a pale IPA, like what we're having here, he wants a much softer ratio in terms of the overall mineral load. He likes kettle hops because he wants kettle hops. He likes that bitterness just like we do. And then a lot of this is sort of the standard techniques, right, you know, that we're just talking about. 1 to 1.3 ounces per gallon.
That's right in the Shellhammer range.
That's right in the Shellhammer range. So, and by the way, if you've never had any of those Balebreaker IPAs, go to Yakima.
The people who've been to Hop and Brew School are sitting here nodding.
Yeah, go to Yakima, go to Balebreaker. They own a hop farm, after all. And boy, they make some wonderful hoppy beers.
Brewery in the middle of a hop field. I mean, you know, what could be better?
Yep. Now, Beechwood Brewing Company up in Long Beach, California, Julian Schrago. I've known Julian for years. Julian is the absolute bomb.com at making IPAs. He also makes a really killer Saison, but for some reason people don't buy it.
Because he makes such good IPAs.
Yeah. And Julian's actually the one who turned me on to water certification. But again, for him, he keeps malt simple. He does a lot of paying attention to what his mash and knockout pHs are. And so, like, for instance, he tries to get that knockout pH between 5.1 and 5.2 for when he's doing his heavily dry hop beers, because he knows, okay, fermentation is going to pull pH down, right? It's going to pull it down into, I think he was saying 4.3, 4.4-ish area. And then, yeah, think about how actually acidic that is. That's kind of amazing, right?
Yeah.
And then the dry hops will push it up, and he starts to get worried if his pH, his finishing pH, ends up above 4.6. Right? If it gets above 4.6, that's when he's starting to go, this tastes flabby. Thank you, sir. All right. And then here's our philosophies. Denny.
Yeah, right. This is, you know, if you care what we do. First of all, don't fear the malt. You know, I still like to use crystal in my IPAs. I may use a lighter crystal than I used to. I may use less of it. But I still feel like, for me, it's an important flavor component. If you use the malt and the hops correctly, it's not going to make your beer too sweet. I want a firm, crisp bitterness. Like I said, I want something that slaps me in the face when I take a sip. I like to blend varieties and types by using that survivables chart and putting together hops that complement each other and blend well. Remember that more calcium will contribute, help you get rid of haze. Calcium makes yeast flocculate more, so the more calcium you have in there, the more it's going to drop stuff out and make a nice, clear, crisp beer for you. And you're always looking for a dry finish with a lingering hop flavor and aroma. When you get done, you want to do a retronasal, breathe out, and you want to taste those hops on your palate.
And for me, my philosophy, I am a pale pilsner guy. I live here in Southern California. I've lived in Southern California for nearly 30 years, right? So for me, like, this sort of IPA, this sort of color on my IPA is exactly what I like. So pale pilsner, good pale or good pilsner. I like to keep my stuff very focused. Like, you know, we were talking, like, how you spread out the oils. I tend to be much more in favor of, like, here, I want a citrus bomb, right? And so I try and dial in my varieties that way. I'm also a fan of doing fewer doses than I absolutely, you know, like, trying to spread out everything. So I may have a little kettle break, and I'll do a whirlpool, and then I'll do a single dry hop. But I also do that because I'm a lazy SOB. And if I try and make life too complicated, I'm going to screw it up.
Okay, so, we got 3 minutes left.
Yep. All right.
So this is the beer that you're drinking right now. Kelsey, Drew, and I kind of came up with the recipe together. The malt was contributed by BSG. The yeast came from Y Yeast, and the hops came from Yakima Chief. And I think we need to give all these people a round of applause to say thank you for helping us make this beer.
And the biggest thing about this beer uses pretty much all the techniques that we just talked about.
Yeah. So here's a recipe for 5.5 gallons. Download the presentation, and you'll get it. If not, we'll have it on our website also.
And we'll also make sure to include a substitution for the Trial 702 if you can't get your hands on it.
because you won't be able to for a couple of years.
Yeah. But, again, if you look at the techniques that we used in it, it's all of this stuff that we just talked about. This beer, in so many ways, like when we tasted it last night for the first time with Kelsey, we were saying, I think universally between all of us, we'd like just a little touch more bitterness, right? There's like about 5 IBUs or so more, just to get a little bit more of a back end punch to it. But here, you get your tropical, you get your dank, a little bit of your dank, you get a lot of citrus, right? Like, I get a lot of pineapple and orange. But a clean, crisp body with just enough malt character. Right? And that's what I love.
Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
We made it. We still have time for questions.
Hey!
So, and also, since Kelsey is here, if anybody has questions about the beer, feel free to ask him, and we'll force him to come up and answer.
Yep.
There's a microphone right there. If you have questions, go up to the microphone, fire away. You can ask us anything you like to about beer, ukuleles, dogs.
Or if you got a comment about the Denny Kong, give us a comment about that, too.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Thanks, guys. I want to clarify the definition of the terms early edition and late addition that you're using in this context? Does early mean like beginning of the boil?
Or yes.
What do you?
Yeah. So for us, early addition would be like a 60-minute type addition, right? Your full boil bitter addition.
Yeah, and late would be, you know, something like from 10 minutes on down, you know. I don't know if that's what YCH meant, but that's what we mean.
Yep.
Hey.
You said that high calcium levels help with increasing the clarity of the beer. What do you mean by high exactly? Is that like 100 ppm, 150?
Yeah, I would say 100 plus.
Okay.
You know? You want to make sure you don't get up to like some insane level like 500 because then all your yeast will drop out.
Well, you can do that if you're a British brewer. Us Americans don't do that at all. I mean, the rule of thumb is always 50 parts per million is the baseline.
Yep.
Denny likes to push it a little bit higher.
Could we get that audience mic turned up a little bit? Is there somebody here who can do that? Oh, I bet I can do it.
I mean, there's a Mackey right over there.
I know. Hang on.
All right.
I'll speak slowly as I can.
There you go.
Anyway, as far as the one note, the elements you talk about with thiols, thiols and terpenes, you said it's about one note. It seems like it's one note. And so you get something with great scent, great aroma, but then the flavor falls flat, does not reflect the aroma.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Very much
for
any of that enhancing stuff. Yeah.
Well, as far as avoiding that and still having that great aroma, you're just talking about more hops or a multiplicity of hops, or what specifically do you do to avoid that one note element and still get that great aroma?
I would say don't concentrate on thiols alone.
Yes,
you know, look at that as one component of the beer and use it in combination with more traditional techniques.
Yeah. I mean, the real problem with thiols right now, I mean, obviously it's the hot thing, right? And everybody's going, well, shit, we've never used this before. Let's use this. Let's really see what this does. But the real problem with thiols is it doesn't take much. Like, it does not take very, very much at all to overwhelm everything else that you're getting out of a beer. So if you're going to play around doing thiol stuff, you've got to be judicious and you've got to be careful about it. I would also argue, make sure you layer in a bunch of stuff in the back end just to give you some base.
So. Thank you.
So you talked about finishing beer pH and that has a huge impact on flavor. Mm-hmm. Is it merely a fact, or is it merely a is the impact really on just correcting that pH when you get to your finished beer? Or does the change happen earlier on with your finishing pH? So, for example, I usually knock out at about 5.05 to 5.1.5 on most beers that I do. But if I'm dry hopping, if I correct for a different pH, is that going to be the same as if I correct earlier on in the process?
Yeah, the thing is, pay attention to the finished wort pH, I think is the technique I've picked up from a lot of brewers. And some of that's just because it's the easiest point in time in which to change it,
right?
And so that's what I'm seeing a lot of people doing as a technique is, okay, what's my finished wort pH? Done with the boil. Okay, add X number of milliliters of lactic acid or phosphoric acid, whichever you choose, and then go from there. And they've learned from experience over time that they'll see this much pH drop from their yeast, this much pH rise from their dry hops, and they can dial it in that way. Push comes to shove, yeah, you could add the acid to your glass too. But
yeah, I'm curious. Have you tried correcting a beer pH after fermentation?
I have not tried doing it in the glass yet. I really should.
Yeah, you should. But tell me about it.
Absolutely. But no, to me, I was really when I started talking to Julian about this because, of course, big, deep, nerdy beer discussions. Love those things, right? But I asked him. I was like, dude, why are your IPAs always so fantastic? And that's when he turned me on to the water acidification because that's what he pays attention to with his dry hop beers.
Cheers. So.
The 48-hour rule on dry hopping,
yep.
Past that you're saying it absorbs stuff back. What if you – can you remove that hops and add other hops? And is that going to –
You would have a
back?
Hell of a time removing it.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, and you know, I mean, I guess you put it in a bag or something, yeah. But
you could, but
I guess the question is why.
Well, to do a different variety, not I don't know.
But you could have put those different varieties in at the beginning too.
Okay.
You
yeah,
know?
And again, I mean, like talking with professional brewers about the whole double dry hop thing. I mean, some of it they do for convenience, right? And they do it because of the volume of their tanks. Some of it, they also do it because it's a marketing term. Hey, whatever, people got to sell beer. For homebrewers, I would generally say just do a single addition. Get all your hops in there at once. And the other thing that you can take away from the professionals is a sort of a rousing step. You know, and we're fortunate in the fact that our fermenters are generally small enough that if you need to, you can just go and give it a shake. Professionals will do it with like a blast of CO2 down through the bottom, or they'll do a recirculation pump or something like that. So just get it in one dose. Mm-hmm. And if you feel really compelled, then yeah, figure out a way to rouse it.
If you think you want to do a double dose, think about why you want to do it. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying that you should be aware of why you want it and what you expect it to do for you. And if you can't define that, then there's no reason to do it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. All righty. Questions.
All right, so two questions ago about pH made me kind of curious. You know, when I'm brewing, I usually just kind of take a pH measurement at mash, mm-hmm. throw it in the fridge first to get it down to temperature and do this, and I kind of just let it sail from that. So keeping in mind, you know, principles like simple homebrewing, yep. how often do you guys find yourselves throughout your process measuring pH, and in what different areas do you actually take the time?
I almost never measure pH because, number one, I have really good water from a well yep. that never changes.
By the way, this is the obnoxious thing that he tells us here in Southern California.
yeah. And I use Bruin water to do my my calculations, and it is so accurate that unless I'm brewing a recipe for the first time, I know it's going to be, I mean, there's no reason to check because I know it's going to be what Bruin water tells me. So if I'm doing a recipe for the first time and I'm not feeling lazy, I'll check the pH.
At what stages?
Pardon?
At what stages?
During the mash, and I have just started getting more into looking at the post-boil acidification for dry hopping. I haven't done a lot of it yet, but I intend to really start exploring that.
Okay.
Yeah, and for me, like, for a lot of the beers I do, because a lot of the beers I do are, like, Saison, for instance, I don't generally matter with the pH because, hey, whatever. I know exactly how that works for me. But if I am doing a hoppy beer, I will do a mash pH. I'll do it at least once when I make a recipe, or at least in the grain bill, so I know, okay, hey, this is roughly how this works with L.A. water during this period of time. L.A. water, unfortunately, not as consistent as Jackass's well water. I'll do
He's
that.
He's so jealous.
I am jealous. You have a freaking well that pours water out at like 50-some-odd degrees.
52 year-round.
52, you jerk. my tap temperature during the middle of summer is 78.
Drew, I feel your pain in Tucson, Arizona.
I'll do at least a mash pH when I'm first using that particular malt bill. But now that I've started doing this with dry hopped beers, I start doing the post-boil check, and that's when I'll make that adjustment. Again, picking up from, like, what Julian does. If it's an IPA thing, I'll look at, like, what Julian does, what Vinny does, and those guys, and I swear to God, they know what they're doing, so I'm going to try my best. For an IPA that's going to be heavily dry-hopped, I'll check mash pH at least once when I'm doing that grain bill for the first time. These days, since most of it is all Pilsner-based, I'm generally okay. But then I'll check that wort pH, and then I'll acidify at the end of the boil.
Okay. And then when you do your pH checks, I assume that's bring it down to temperature and measure it at room temperature? Okay.
Yep.
All right. Thank you both.
Yep.
All right. Any other questions? Show of hands, how many people like this beer? Yeah. All right. Show of hands, how many of you would pay for a pint of this beer? There we go. That's the more important measure.
Hey, Phil.
Hey, Denny and Drew. One thing I wanted to say, when you were talking about the beer you held, and I have longer arms that you could hold that far out and you could still smell it because of the thiols and everything. I last month went to a talk, and it was a researcher and then the lady who's running the lab over at Omega Labs, and we had just used the Cosmic Punch yeast. Uh-huh. And so they were doing some thiol stuff, and what was so interesting about it was they gave us three beers commercially produced. One was honest to goodness, all pale malt, and no dry hop or anything else. And that was the most aromatic. And it turned out that the source of thiols for those thiolized yeasts are the pale malts.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And so if you, and it, as it turned out, the more dry hop you did, the more you were creeping into that aroma.
Right.
And a lot of it had to do with when you were dry hopping, because a lot of those aromatics will just blow right out of the tube.
Yep. Right. So, I, at Hop and Brew School last year, I had a chance to interview Laura Burns from Omega, Joss Ruffle, who invented Phantasm, and then a couple of the Yakima Chief people who are heavily involved in that same area. And the point that they all made was that the main source of thiols was coming from the malt, and that that was really, really important.
Yep. Yeah, I guess the biggest thing when we did an internal competition between two sets of brewers, I kid you not, the guys who did more, you know, they brought Phantasm, they right. brought, you know, what was that? Not the, I'm trying to think of the secret sauce stuff, the, can't think of what it was.
Oh, like but anyway, Incognito or something?
Yeah, it was, I don't know. But it was, the biggest thing was they, people were really disappointed, and even they were disappointed in how much aroma and flavor they got out of it because everything was clashing and it was just like dropping out.
Yep, yeah, I mean, that's right.
So to me, I think if you're going to go thiol forward aroma beer, you have to focus a lot of your other hop usage on providing that solid base of bitter and flavor.
Yeah, it gets back to more is not necessarily better.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, thiols are so weirdly tricky. I mean, it's like some of those are parts per trillion, you know, in terms of like your sensitivity to them. All right. So and more questions, we can take them up here. Also, show of hands. How many people would adjust the bitterness of this beer up? All right. How many of the people would adjust the bitterness of the beer down?
Okay. And how many think it's just right?
All right. Yeah. So largely between just right and just a little up, which is kind of our conclusion as well, right? By the way, I'm making that comment not as saying, well, this beer is a giant pile of crap, but it doesn't meet my expectations. This beer is fantastic.
Yeah.
So let's make sure we get that out there. All right, last questions.
No?
Somewhere I can't destroy
it. It was a choice between the ukulele and the Red Chuck Taylors in my suitcase and the Red Chucks one. Okay, everybody, thanks a bunch. Be sure to say thanks to Kelsey on your way out for this amazing beer.
Well, and hey, don't forget, we are going to be doing a book signing here very shortly.
That's right, book signing at 3 o'clock, and tomorrow over in the trade show at 12:30, we're going to be recording a live podcast. Come on by, harass us, ask us embarrassing questions.
And if you had questions that you didn't want to ask on the mic, please come up and ask us.